That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the now.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, someone said the other day that they had no idea that we have a bunch of series that are available to any and all subscribers at any and all levels. And I wanted to take a second and point those out, because I think one of the things that we try to do at the podcast is, of course, provide a deep historical background of current events. And I think what we did that last week with our episode on the decision for the founders to declare independence. If you haven't listened to that, because it was the July 4th weekend, I think, Derek, that was one of the best episodes that we've ever done. So check that out. But I also wanted to just let everyone know we have a bunch of series that, usually the first episode or two, those are available to everyone, so you could see if you're into it. But at whatever level, the $5 level, the annual level, anyone could access these series, and we spend a lot of time developing them. You could just find them at AmericanPrestigePod.com/series. And so I'm just going to quickly run through them in case any of these sound of interest. We did one on 20th century Iraq and the rise of Ba'athism, the ideology of Saddam Hussein and the movement around him. We did one on a history of modern Palestine, great, with Rashid Khalidi. I think one of the best things we've ever done. Another one that I think is truly excellent with Daniel Hummel is one on Christian Zionism. And these are all multi-episode series that really allow you to get into this. We did one on, we've titled Gun Country with historian Drew McKevitt about the how did America become so armed? What happened there? How did guns actually spread throughout this society? We did one with big friend of the pod, Alexander Avina, on the lessons of Guerrero on peasant guerrilla organizations. We did one with another, I guess everyone here who spent their time to do this is a friend of the pod, with Sam Hunica on queer Germany, which I think doubles as a history of modern homosexuality and the history of modern Germany. We talk a lot about the rise of Nazism and all those topics. We did one with the political theorist, actually, Stephen Eich, on the currency of politics, to talk about how money, the idea of money, is shaped in the history of political thought. We did one with my old friend Fritz Bartel on the end of the Cold War. How and why did the Cold War end when it did? We did a multi-part series on the history of Afghanistan. That was the second one we did with another friend of mine, Tim Noonan. We did, these are all old friends of mine, funny how that works, with my old friend from Duke, Brian Pitts, on the history of Brazil, a full-on history of Brazil. The first one we did, and I think what led the way, was this excellent series with Sean Fear, the historian, on Vietnam, just the history of Vietnam and the Vietnamese War and beyond. Another one with my colleague and friend James Lin on the history of Taiwan. We're still in the midst of a history of the IRA series. Another one we did on the history of the Kurds with me and Jean Bajalan. Another one with Lissandro Claudio on the history of the Philippines. Another one with my colleague Margaret O'Mara on the making of Silicon Valley, which gets into the deep history of Silicon Valley. We have one with my friend Mike Brennis, our friend Mike Brennis, on the military-industrial complex, how that came to be. Another one with the great Aziz Rana on the American Constitution and how the Constitution has been viewed in U.S. history. And another one with my friend Terry Renault on the New Left and what was the New Left exactly. And these are all, I should add, these are not single episodes. These are multi-part episodes and multi-part series that you could kind of sink into. And I just wanted to highlight them because I think it's one of the best things we've done on this show. So again, usually the first episode or two, those are free. And they're available to any subscribers. And check that out at AmericanPrestigePod.com/series. All right, Derek, now that we've done that, and thank you everyone for listening, let's jump into the news. And let's start with the NATO summit, which has ended on a high note.
Somewhat unexpectedly ended on a high note. Donald Trump came into the NATO summit in Turkey this week, mad at NATO, as he usually is, in this case, mostly because, again, they failed to jump into the Iran war, as well, as glorious as that conflict was. For some reason, European NATO members didn't want to do much, didn't want to involve themselves very much in it. Many of them, or most of them, did allow the U.S. to use their air bases, which is involvement enough, I guess. But he wanted more, especially when he got frustrated over the Strait of Hormuz, which, you know, is still an issue. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But he has been quite irritated with NATO, even more than usual. He came into the alliance, or came into the summit, reiterating his demand that Greenland should be part of the United States. So he's back to playing the hits in that sense. This was something that seemed to be sort of at least kind of swept under the rug, if not actually resolved. But he came back into the this summit once again, demanding that NATO turn Greenland over to the U.S. He's been throwing temper tantrum at people. We've talked about it on the show. He's been, you know, having back and forth insult contests with Georgia Maloney. He's been insulting Keir Starmer. He's been very angry. So he showed up. They had their summit. There are a couple of things we can talk about that happened on the sidelines of the summit involving other countries, both in and out of the alliance. But the upshot is he left the summit apparently happy with how it went. He talked about the tremendous time that he had and a great success. I think they all signed each other's yearbooks and, you know, agreed to stay in touch when school starts in the fall again. So it was great, great fun. Everybody had a good time. They issued a joint statement, which may not necessarily have happened given the level of rancor that there was seemed to be going in. But they did issue a joint statement reaffirming their commitment to Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which is the mutual defense obligation, the thing that really makes NATO NATO. Somewhat surprisingly, it did end fairly positively. Trump did not get control of Greenland. And he did at one point in a particularly petulant fit order, Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who was there, I don't know, attending Trump or something, ordered him to stop trading with Spain, which is the second time he's done that, and really isn't like the latitude for the U.S. to do that, since the U.S. trades with Spain through the European Union and not on a one-to-one basis, is probably limited. But he's nevertheless still quite angry, at least at Spain, which makes sense because the Spanish government hasn't really jumped to attention about his demands for higher defense spending. And it didn't. It was one of the NATO states that did not contribute at all, didn't even allow the U.S. To use bases in Spain to facilitate the Iran war. So his level of irritation there is still high. But overall, he did not rage at anybody. And, you know, for NATO heads out there, I guess you can feel safe that the U.S. is at least going to remain in the alliance for another year. We'll see where things stand next year. And we still don't know the extent to which Trump is planning to withdraw U.S. military forces from Europe. That's an ongoing debate, I think, within the administration.
So this past week, I did one of my favorite podcasts, BungaCast, formerly known as Alpha Bunga Bunga. And it's people who might not necessarily be in Europe now, but are from the UK. And it's one of the big divides. It was interesting between my, I'm like, the US is positioned in NATO and Europe is on borrowed time. And even though these are left-wing critics, my sense was that they thought that the United States was not going to give up direct involvement or severe direct involvement in Europe. And to my mind, that is a matter of when, not if. Before we move on to Iran, Derek, what do you think of that? Do you think that the U.S. is just going to be kind of all this Sturm und Drang with Trump, or do you think the U.S. is actually going to remain in Europe just forever, kind of?
I do think it's going to remain. I mean, you know, what we may get, and again, we still don't know how much they're planning to actually withdraw forces from Europe. Like, Pete Hegseth had this plan to just stop an entire rotation of forces from coming in, which would have cut things down considerably. He then got talked out of it, I think, by Trump, or, you know, Trump after getting an earful from somebody in Poland, Karol Nawrocki maybe, or somebody who he finds, you know, ideologically comforting, kind of urged him. And I guess he likes Poland because Poland is one of the more sycophantic NATO countries in general toward the U.S. And they kind of reverse track on that. Now that, you know, there's been this talk that they've presented NATO with documents saying that they're not going to contribute the same level of forces to the sort of joint, it's not a joint force, but the collective force that could be mustered in the event of a crisis, that the U.S. is kind of pulling capabilities out of that and saying, you know, we're not going to contribute this. We're not going to contribute this. You're going to have to do this. You know, Europeans are going to have to take care of, you know, these particular things. But that's still not finalized, and we still don't really know how that's going to play out. And the Europeans, you know, supposedly it's going to happen on a time frame that allows the European nations to step up while the U.S. pulls down, you know, draws down. But you know, who knows at this point? And I think what you'll probably see is wherever things are at the end of this administration, when the I still think it's inevitable that a Democrat's going to win in 28. Maybe, you know, maybe they'll figure out a way to rig it for JT or JD or something. But if there is a Democrat, I think you're going to get the same thing you got with the Biden administration after the first Trump term, where they sort of say, well, let's just keep things the way they are. Like, they may campaign against it. They may rage against it and say, we have to get back to into Europe and be, you know, nice to our allies and a greater participant in NATO. But then when they get in, they'll kind of say, let's start from where Trump left off and just kind of leave things there, which happened on a lot of fronts for Biden. So that's my suspicion. I think it's going to stick indefinitely for the long term, but the level at which the U.S. is deployed in Europe may decrease somewhat.
Let's move on to Iran. And of course, biggest news of the week is that, although it's not, it's interesting what gets covered and what's not. Obviously, the Plattner story is an important one and it has taken over the media, but I feel like this has gotten almost no coverage. And it's quite important. There's new fighting between the United States and Iran, and Trump has even declared the ceasefire over. So what's happened, Derek?
Right. The Iranians apparently fired on three commercial vessels in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday, kind of overnight, Tuesday. All three of them were damaged. There was one, a liquefied natural gas tanker with a Qatari flag, I believe. That caught fire. Fire on a liquefied natural gas tanker is a very serious thing. No casualties, no injuries or deaths, as far as I know, on these ships. But the Qataris lodged a protest. The UK Maritime Trade Operations Center, which is one of the major maritime monitoring services in the world, raised its alert level for the Strait of Hormuz to severe. And then the Trump administration announced that it was withdrawing its waiver on Iranian oil sanctions, which is one of the core elements of the memorandum of understanding supposed to undergird the ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran. So withdrawing that was a huge step to take. It hadn't yet really been implemented, so it didn't cost the Iranians anything in terms of losing revenue necessarily, but it did basically tear the guts out of the MOU. The U.S. then followed that up Tuesday evening, kind of overnight into Wednesday, with another round of airstrikes against Iranian targets in and around the Strait of Hormuz in southern Iran. This round seemed to be more extensive than previous. I mean, people who've been following this story know there have been a few instances of kind of back and forth violence. This one seemed to be a little more severe, from what I understand, a little more expansive. The Iranians retaliated with strikes on Kuwait and Bahrain, ostensibly U.S. facilities in those countries. That then prompted Donald Trump on Wednesday to decree that the memorandum of understanding, this was while he was in Ankara still wrapping up the NATO summit, to decree that the memorandum of understanding is over. Basically, the ceasefire is over. He very petulantly talked to reporters about this and said he doesn't want to deal with the Iranians anymore and negotiations are a waste of time. He might as well have been kicking rocks, I think, while he was doing this. But That was then followed up with another round of airstrikes Wednesday evening, overnight into Thursday, with the Iranians again retaliating. I think, again, this is a little more severe than what we've seen in past go-rounds. And there's no sense that it's over, so we'll probably see another. We may, or at least may see another one Thursday night into Friday. And who knows at this point, we may be set for, now that the MOU has been declared over, we may see this repeated over and over again indefinitely. It is not a return to full-scale war. It's not even a return to the blockades. That hasn't happened yet. It could happen. It's one of the options, I think, on the table for both Trump and the Iranians to impose the Iranians' case, you know, to shut down the Strait of Hormuz completely. Again, for the U.S. to impose its blockade on Iran again. Effectively, the Iranians have shut down the Strait of Hormuz, my understanding from the latest maritime tracking information, ship tracking information, is that there is no traffic at this point in the Strait of Hormuz after the latest uptick in violence. Oil prices are back up a bit. Stock markets crashed on Wednesday, or at least they were crashing in the middle of the day when I checked after Trump announced that the MOU was over in response to all of this. And according to Axios, the White House is preparing for this to last for days or even weeks. And, you know, whether it escalates beyond kind of, you know, every night we shoot at each other into something more severe remains to be seen. Anything, I guess, is on the table. There doesn't seem to be a huge appetite on either side to resume what they were doing a couple of months ago, but that could still escalate to that point if nobody is able to put the brakes on what's happening now.
Yeah, just permanent low-level conflict everywhere. Also, let's talk about the estimate of the war costs.
A friend of the show, Stephen Semler, did a new estimate at the Popular Information newsletter. His previous estimate that he did in May was that the war had cost $71.8 billion for its first 60 days. Notably, the Trump administration, when it made its supplemental funding request to Congress recently, asked for $72 billion to cover the cost of the war. So I think he was pretty close to being on the money, as it were. But he did a new estimate based on costs accruing beyond the first 60 days of the war, so through basically 4 months of war blockade and, you know, whatever's been happening in the last few weeks. And his new estimate is more than $103 billion have been spent by the Pentagon on this conflict. All well spent, I think, you know, definitely worth it. But that's just for the direct costs, and he specifies this in the piece. You can read it at Popular Information, but it is the direct budgetary costs of operations, fielding personnel, the material that's being used. So that's where your money's going, is to maintain this nonsense in the Persian Gulf.
Derek, so cynical. That's not like you. Let's turn to Israel-Palestine. Big news of the week is that Hamas has dissolved the government.
In theory, it has. On Monday, Hamas announced that it was dissolving its government and handing authority over to the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza. This is the technocratic, so-called technocratic body that is supposed to run Gaza on a day-to-day basis under the so-called Board of Peace. The import of this may not amount to all that much. It's a symbolic gesture at this point, in part because the Israeli government hasn't allowed the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza to actually come into Gaza, any of its members. It hasn't allowed it to really assume its responsibilities while it continues to demand that Hamas disarm. There was nothing in Monday's announcement about disarmament or standing down the resistance, anything like that. And the Israeli government consequently dismissed the gesture of dissolving the government as meaningless. Was probably intended on Hamas's part to force the issue somewhat, because the ceasefire, as it, you know, let's say so-called ceasefire, the plan, the agenda, the process, or whatever you want to call it, has been stalled largely over this issue of disarmament, which, you know, again, as we've talked about before, Hamas is arguing that disarmament should come at the end of a process that's leading to a Palestinian state, and the Israelis are demanding disarmament now, basically, again, kind of surrendering the idea of resistance before any further progress is allowed to happen. And so Hamas, by dissolving the government, may be trying to force the issue, leaving the territory, if they do actually go through with it, leaving it without an administrative arm or administrative apparatus, which would force somebody to do something, whether it was the Board of Peace or Israel or whatever, to bring either bring the committee in or find some other way to administer the territory. So that may be where Hamas is at. Again, I don't know that this dissolution is actually going to happen in a meaningful sense, but we'll see.
And the Board of Peace looks set to prepare a humanitarian zone. Tell us about that.
Right. Reuters reported this on Wednesday that they are going to move ahead again with their negotiations with Hamas stalled over basically the issue of disarmament. They're going to move forward with the creation of what is being termed a pilot humanitarian zone. It's not clear where the zone would be located, but presumably in Israeli, part of the 70 to 80% at this point of Gaza that is controlled by the IDF, where the Israeli forces have been doing really thorough demolition work in, for example, Rafah in the southern part of Gaza or parts of eastern Gaza, that could be, you know, looked at as preparing sites for potential sites for these so-called humanitarian zones. The process here, as we know it, as it's been reported in a few outlets at this point, will involve basically the voluntary relocation of some number of Palestinians to the humanitarian zone. So people will be asked to sign up. They'll be vetted once they do sign up. But the draw will be basically much improved living conditions because, you know, the Israelis will not block aid basically to these encampments as they've done to the rest of Gaza, to Hamas-controlled Gaza. So that's being dangled as the carrot to entice people to sign up for living in these places. The National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, will be responsible for ultimately administering these humanitarian camps with an internal police force that's affiliated and staffed by Palestinians and is affiliated with the committee, providing internal security. External security will, of course, be provided handled. I shouldn't say provided because who wants this, but by the IDF. And that's going to involve things like, you know, again, it's been reported by Drop Site and other sites, The Intercept, I think other outlets have reported this, biometric scans for people coming in and out, intensive round-the-clock surveillance of every part of these camps. Drop Site in January described it as an Israeli panopticon, which I think is a pretty apt term to use. So it's basically a dystopian nightmare these people are going to be living in, but they will be given food and water and the basic elements of survival as a compensation for living in the panopticon. There will be no involvement, obviously, from Hamas in this. And again, you know, how this meshes with their announcement on Monday is unclear.
Aren't we all living in a panopticon, Derek? No, actually, this is much, much worse.
Some more than others, yeah.
Yeah, some more than others, certainly. All right, let's turn on to Turkey, where Trump might be prepared to sell the country F-35s.
Right. On Tuesday, as he was arriving for the NATO summit, Trump met with Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey. And of course, they're very, shall we say, similar types of people and seem to get along pretty well.
Flight provider to Eric Adams, former mayor of New York
City. Yeah. So they had a meeting and you know, seemed to yuck it up and be chummy. And Trump told reporters that he is going to be removing sanctions from Turkey. He's talking about the sanctions that were imposed by the U.S. Congress under the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, which was passed in 2017, really dealt mainly with Russia, North Korea, and Iran. But what happened here is Turkey, when Erdogan agreed to buy Russia's S-400 air defense system a couple of years later in 2019, opened Turkey up that opened Turkey up to sanctions, and Congress basically excised Turkey from the F-35 program. So Turkish industry was supposed to be involved in part of the manufacturing process for the F-35s, and then the Turkish military was supposed to get a small number, I think, of F-35s at the end of the line. You know, let's assume that the F-35 is something people actually want, which, you know, I don't know at this point, but Erdogan does seem to want it, at least for status reasons, if nothing else. And so he's been pressuring Trump, especially in the second term since he came back to office, to undo CATSA and restore the F-35 sales to Turkey. He kind of pressured the Biden administration. He didn't have the same affinity with the Biden administration that he does with the Trump administration. So that was a little bit of a harder sell. But Trump now says he's going to be taking the sanctions off. He didn't say whether he's going to actually sell F-35s to Turkey, which, you know, sounds somewhat contradictory because the sanctions have to do with blocking Turkey from acquiring F-35s. So if you're going to take the sanctions off, one assumes you would be, you know, supportive of the sale. Where this is going to run into opposition is in Congress, because Congress will have to undo the sanctions that it imposed. Trump can't do that for them. And Turkey does not have a great reputation in Congress at this point. There are a lot of Republicans, especially, who are heavily critical of the Turkish government, heavily critical of Erdogan. Erdogan and Benjamin Netanyahu do not get along, at least rhetorically. Which only fuels additional kind of suspicion about Turkey and hostility to the F-35 sale in Congress and in Israel. Netanyahu has been doing interviews this week, kind of, you know, arguing against the sale. He wants Israel to be the only country in the region that has the F-35, so he's opposed to that. So that may be an interesting fight if it gets that far. Again, Trump didn't really seem to commit to anything, so who knows? There's also still the matter of the S-400, and the concern at the time was that you're going to operate the F-35 with this S-400 system, or however many S-400 systems Turkey eventually acquires or was looking to eventually acquire. And the S-400 is going to be able to collect intelligence. Its systems will collect data on the F-35 that will somehow, you know, through some trapdoor or, you know, secret means, transmit that information to Russia. And, you know, we can't have them learning the secrets of how we asphyxiate our pilots. So, that's still a problem, and it's unclear how Erdogan would try to alleviate that. He could move the S-400 to an overseas military base and just, you know, promise that the twain shall never meet, that the F-35 will never be, Turkish F-35s will never be deployed anywhere near Turkish S-400s. But who knows? Again, it's a kind of an unknown at this point, I think.
The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI? Or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
So, Derek, you and I are obviously pro-hunks. This is a pro-hunk podcast. And for whatever disagreements with Donald Trump, he is also pro-hunk.
He appreciates a hunky guy. Yeah.
He appreciates a hunk, a good hunk. So this relates to this story because, Derek, tell us about the United States removing Syria from the state sponsors of terrorism list.
This was on Wednesday. He met with Ahmed Ashara on the sidelines of the NATO summit again. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio made the announcement that the U.S. is removing Syria from the state-sponsored terrorism list. I'm a little surprised it's taken them this long. I mean, Trump has hosted Shara at the White House like months ago in November, I think, which is not something you typically do with a sponsor of terrorism. So it's a little surprising it's taken this long. It will take effect in 45 days now that the State Department has started the ball rolling, unless the U.S. Congress intervenes. That seems highly unlikely. There's a lot of good feeling about Shara and his plucky little post-jihadist government in Congress. So I doubt that there's going to be any move to block this removal, which should carry some economic benefits for Syria. Being designated state-sponsored terrorism, unsurprisingly, comes with a number of automatic and quite biting economic sanctions. So this should be good for the Syrian economy, at least.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Sudan, and let's start with civilians fleeing El Obeid.
Save the Children reported this. Over 11,000 people have fled El Obeid in Sudan's North Kordofan state over the past 2 weeks. As people know, El Obeid has been besieged by the Rapid Support Forces militant group. It's really been besieged for months, but lately, the RSF and its various allies have been deploying additional forces to surround the city. And this has triggered warnings from the United Nations, the United States, all manner of international actors that there's an imminent RSF attack in the works against El Obeid, which has raised fears of another humanitarian disaster, war crime spectacle, like what the RSF inflicted on El Fasher in North Darfur state. And so, you know, people are unsurprisingly trying to break through the siege and get out of there. There's a humanitarian crisis in addition to just sort of waiting for the attack to come and for whatever atrocities will be carried out. There's still over 500,000 people in El Obeid, many of them displaced from other parts of Kordofan. So, you know, this is a drop in the bucket, but it is an indication that people are in the city are aware of what's happening and are trying to get away from it. The attack itself, as I said, it's been weeks now that they've been we've been getting warnings of an imminent attack. It still hasn't come. So maybe the RSF is still trying to muster additional forces. Maybe, you know, some of the counterattacking and the drone strikes that have come from the Sudanese military have impacted their timetable. It's unclear, but this still seems to be a looming threat.
Thank you, Derek. All right, let's also talk about this military recapture of a border town.
Right. On Wednesday, the Sudanese military announced that its forces had recaptured Kurmuk, which is a border town in southeastern Sudan's Blue Nile state. It's right on the Ethiopian border. Again, we've talked about this in past weeks. The RSF and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, or a faction of it, have started an offensive in Blue Nile earlier this year and took Kurmuk. That was their biggest success in that offensive. Kurmuk, given its position on the Ethiopian border, is a strategic location. The Sudanese military has accused the Ethiopian government of aiding the RSF and the SPLM in their offensive, funneling recruits and materiel through Kurmuk to the militants. So the Ethiopian government has denied this, but if that's going on, then Kurmuk has obviously, you know, been an important conduit for those that support. So retaking it, and the Sudanese military has been kind of on a counteroffensive in Blue Nile for a few weeks now, pushing toward Kurmuk as one of its main goals. So this would be, assuming it's true, assuming that they actually have retaken it, a pretty significant development there.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Mali, and let's talk about the new joint rebel offensive there.
Similar to the one that was carried out in late April involving Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, jihadists, and the Azawad Liberation Front rebels in northern Mali, there was another operation over the weekend that targeted, I think, five locations across Mali, three towns in the north, and then a town in the Mopti region in central Mali, and a town or village in the Kulikoro region in southern Mali, very close to Bamako, the capital, again, seems to have been coordinated between the FLA and JNIM. I haven't seen any details in terms of the outcome of that offensive and whether the rebels or the jihadists were able to really take any of these towns or you know take new territory or military bases in the operations. But I think just important to note that this coordination is still going on and still seems to be a serious challenge that the Malian military and the ruling junta don't have a great answer for.
Thank you, as always, Derek. Let's talk about Trump licensing to Ukraine Patriot missiles. We should probably do another update on Ukraine. We should get the war nerd guys on. They're Ukraine heads. They know all the details.
That would be a good idea. Yeah, so Ukraine, as people may know, is perpetually running short on air defense missiles. They have developed, it seems, some capability for intercepting Russian drones, either electronically or kinetically, as it were. But they're perpetually running short of munitions that can take down Russian ballistic missiles. And there was an attack earlier this week on Kyiv. The Russian military has been hitting the Ukrainian capital pretty hard over the last week or so. That in which the Russians fired 29 ballistic missiles, and I think all 29 of them made it to target because there was nothing the Ukrainians could do to intercept them. And in particular, they are always they've always kind of, you know, they're always looking for Patriot missiles. Basically, they have some Patriot batteries, but they, you know, run through their missiles fairly quickly. And Patriots are in short supply around the world, partly thanks to the glorious war in Iran. And so, you know, the Ukrainians are looking, trying to stretch their supply of Patriots. They're, you know, asking European countries to send their Patriot missiles, which European countries are somewhat reluctant to do because they want to maintain their own air defenses. The United States, you know, Trump's desire to simply send munitions to Ukraine is obviously pretty low. He's more amenable to selling weapons to Ukraine, but even there's only so many Patriot missiles to go around, and the U.S. has used quite a number of them in the Iran war. So there's just a general shortage here. Trump on Wednesday again met along on the sidelines of the NATO summit, met with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and made this big kind of backslapping announcement that, hey, we're going to license you guys to produce your own Patriot missiles, and this is supposed to satisfy Zelensky and satisfy his critics. I don't know that Trump understands what is at issue here necessarily, but this is not a short-term solution for Ukraine's air defense missile shortage problem. Licensing Ukraine to produce its own Patriots is one thing. Building the capability, the factories, and the capabilities to start manufacturing Patriot missiles in volume is another thing entirely, and it could be years before Ukraine is able to do that. I've seen people suggest that Trump was making like a backhanded offer to Ukraine that he'll now turn around and say, well, we've licensed you to make your own Patriots. We don't have to provide you with any Patriots anymore. I'm not sure he's clever enough to have thought of that, but that's effectively, that may be what he does. He hasn't, you know, they haven't made any announcements as far as like, you know, are we going to continue selling Patriots to Europe or selling Patriots that get, you know, transferred onto Ukraine or not. But if he's looking at this as a substitute for providing actual missiles to Ukraine, it is not, at least in the short term. And the Ukrainians presumably know that, but I don't know how they feel about the gesture that he seems to think he made.
Let's turn to Peru, where Roberto Sanchez has conceded the presidential election.
Yeah, Sanchez conceded on Monday to Keiko Fujimori. He had previously been challenging the results of their runoff, in which Fujimori won a very, very narrow victory. Been challenging particularly the expatriate vote, which broke heavily for Fujimori. He was alleging fraud in that vote in particular. He's apparently given up that challenge. So Keiko Fujimori, fifth time's the charm. Or maybe it's fourth time. I've lost track. But will be the next president of Peru. And there's now, understandably, a lot of fear that her presidency is going to go the way her father's did, Alberto Fujimori, who, of course, ruled as essentially a dictator from 1990 to 2000. So, fun times may be on the horizon for Peru.
And what about the Colombian presidential transition?
Right. This is another... process that seems to have gone off the rails. Abelardo de la Espriella, the far-right figure, Trump-backed, who won Colombia's presidential election last month, announced on Tuesday, or his campaign announced on Tuesday, that they are suspending the transition process. This was after the outgoing president, Gustavo Petro, reiterated his suspicions that there was fraud involved in De La Espriella's victory in last month's runoff. He hasn't produced anything, at least conclusive, in terms of evidence to support that claim. But De La Espriella accused Petro of laying the groundwork for a coup to prevent the handover of power. And as I said, announced that they are cutting off the transition process. So that situation could get ugly if it continues on this course.
And in huge news, Derek, the end of an era is here. The United States military is dropping Indo-Pacific from its discourse, I guess. So tell us about that.
End of a, what, like 7-year era, I guess. No, I don't know when they changed.
Right? Second Obama?
PACOM. No, it was Trump. It was Trump. First Trump.
It was Trump. Oh, okay. Because Obama, that's when I remember first starting to hear.
2018. So it's been 8 years. No, I mean, Obama was when you started to hear Indo-Pacific, but this specifically it refers to the Pentagon changing U.S. Indo-Pacific Command back to U.S. Pacific Command. Which is its former name. It was rebranded in, I think, 2018 to reflect the new, at that time, concept that the U.S. was going to deal with China by surrounding it, and that made the Indian Ocean and India as big an element of containing China as the Pacific, and really reflected the effort that had been going on until like last year to bring India into closer alignment with the United States. Now that Donald Trump is mad at India, or, you know, got mad at India last year, frustrated with over trade and over, India's, the Indian government, Narendra Modi's refusal to credit Trump with ending their brief conflict with Pakistan last year. Now that that's happened, we don't want to be friends with India anymore, basically. And, the focus is back on the Pacific, and in particular on the so-called first island chain, which is, everything from Taiwan and the Philippines to Japan. And the idea being that if you're going to contain China, this is where you have to do it. And it's based on strengthening U.S. alliances with those states and positioning greater amounts of U.S. Military assets, especially in Japan and the Philippines. There's even a new, not a new group, but a newly promoted group, I guess. Danny, you may be familiar with the Quad. Which was the U.S., India, Japan, and Australia. Who could not be familiar with
the Quad? Like, I love my quads. Yeah.
Well, that's out. The Quad is out now, and the Squad is in, which is basically the same thing as the Quad, except you remove India and add the Philippines. And that's the group that's now apparently getting all the glory in Washington, or the luster The Quad has been demoted from, and this was in the National Security Strategy, I think, last year, has been demoted from a principals group, which means, you know, when it meets, it's the, you know, heads of state or heads of government of all those countries that get together, to a foreign ministers group. So you get the Secretary of State and his counterparts in the other countries take the lead on that. The Squad now is the new hotness. And that's where things stand. I don't know. I mean, I know you have thoughts about the U.S. position in the Pacific. I think a lot of this is motivated by, you know, petulance over Modi and Trump being mad at India. Not that it ever meant anything to begin with, but it's sort of an indication to me of how silly these, you know, branding things are and how little they actually matter.
Well, how dare you say that about, especially an administration that renamed the Department of Defense Department of War, which will take about 3 seconds for whoever wins in 2020. Well, if a Democrat wins, I think they'll turn it back. And if a Republican wins, they won't.
There's nothing to turn back. I mean, it's not an official change.
Not an official change. I mean, the sort of glorious, it would be interesting. I haven't yet seen a real intellectual history of why the change was made in the early 2010s. I think it related to this, like, pivot to Asia thing that Obama tried to do in the second term. I remember first really hearing the term in 2012, 2013. Second term, to me, it's very second term Obama, which is that we're moving away from the war on terror. We're going to focus on great power relations. Asia is the major sphere. You know, basically second term Obama pre-ISIS. And then it kind of dissipated once the United States got bogged down again in the Middle East. Funny how that seems to happen all the time. But I mean, again, discursively, it's obviously meaningless, but it suggests this type of strategic disarray that you have the material realities of the U.S. power position in Asia so obviously changing, but you have a foreign policy establishment that is atavistic, that comes through a certain set of institutions, that has a particular view of the United States' ability to project power abroad, coming up against that material reality I just mentioned. So I think that the next few years is going to be very interesting. Again, just to mention that podcast I did, the Bunga Cast, we talked a lot about sort of that notion of the guys there were more bullish on the United States sort of maintaining its empire, and I'm a bit more bearish. I guess it's an interpretation of the national security strategy with Trump, where it says basically two different things. It says both that the United States is going to retain its power position and you know, protect Taiwan, and then it says our primary thing to do in East Asia is like compete economically. I'm more, you know, the materialist. I think the material realities are going to win out over time, but we are in this transitional, dangerous moment where with the wrong people making the wrong decisions, bad things could happen. But to me, it just seems like obvious the United States' position in this region is going to be more and more reduced as opposed to revivified in any meaningful way. And I wouldn't, you know, all this type of stuff is symptomatic of that broader material reality, to my mind, at least. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I when push comes to shove, the U.S. isn't going to defend the first island chain if it means World War III. So that, to me, that's the bottom line. Like, if it actually comes to it, we've talked about this before. Like, I think if there is a conflict that's brewing with China over Taiwan, it will look more like Ukraine than anything else. It will be carefully done to support Taiwan without risking a direct conflict. And that puts that everything else, I think, is window dressing. It's bluster to try and either deter China or maintain this idea that the U.S. is, you know, dominant in all parts of the globe, which we know at this point is not the case. So, yeah, I don't put much stock in it.
Yeah, I mean, and this, I think the big thing that really gets me here is that the Dylan Riley point about sort of industrial capitalism, I think you could apply it here to military industrial capitalism, which is that the United States has invested so much money in this plant, like the aircraft carriers and the jets and everything, the submarines. Submarines are a bit different, but still, and these are just 20th and early 21st century.
I mean, he's building battleships. Like, he wants to build battleships.
Like Mahan.
Like, that's not
like, literally Alfred Thayer Mahan in the 1890.
Right.
The influence of sea power upon history. One of the big takeaways is you need battleships, which is actually what World War I proved incorrect.
I mean, aircraft carriers are borderline, you know, like going to be obsolete. And you want to build battleships.
No, they're obsolete. I mean, just think about 100,000 drones coming out the latest. It's just like you cannot defend against that.
Right.
And so I just don't know what is going to, I mean.
I don't think he has any coherent thought about this other than like it would be cool if we had battleships and I could say I built battleships and it's the Trump class, you know, battleship
like Teddy Roosevelt literally
like he doesn't care beyond that. He just wants something big and big and beautiful in his mind that shows how great he is. And it's, you know, whether it makes any military sense or not, I think is secondary.
Yeah, well, all this money needs to go somewhere. I mean, if you were, even if you're a good old imperialist, like you should just be investing in like giant catch net systems where like you just like put like nets around the aircraft carrier that kill the drones. Because what is it? You can't project power in the current offensive defensive environment, and just like no one's talking about
that. There was a moment after he announced that he wanted to up the $1 trillion Pentagon budget to $1.5 trillion where there were pieces talking about like officials in the Defense Department who had no idea what they were going to do with another $500 billion. Of course, that got buried very quickly. And now the narrative's like, oh, yeah, we need that. Yeah, we need that $1.5 trillion. We can't live without it. Otherwise, we'll be, surrendering to China. We'll all be speaking Mandarin in, 2 years. But, the initial reaction out of the Pentagon was like, what are we going to do with another $500 billion? And that's it. Like, you have to, if you're going to allocate the money, it's got to go to something. And why not something that's going to be sunk in the first 15 seconds of a real conflict, but looks impressive at least.
Well, I mean, and this is just, and obviously the Trump Republican Party approach is silly, but I was just thinking the other day about the Biden military Keynesian approach, right? Because you can in theory say you have this money and you're going to do military Keynesianism, but when that interacts with the fact that basically all these factories are automated, or there's a lot of third party things, then you don't get the military Keynesian, because the Biden had the whole foreign policy for the middle class thing. I'm thinking about this because this 2028 approach is like, I think that there's really a risk amongst Democratic Party candidates to retreat into what might be thought of, or as I think of it, at least as a soft humanitarianism. I think you saw this with the AOC speech, which is that like, what is the left-wing foreign policy? It's kind of like a soft humanitarian foreign policy. Which I obviously don't think works for a variety of reasons. So I was thinking like, what is the other approach? And the other approach is kind of like the Biden-Sullivan foreign policy for the middle class, pseudo-military Keynesianism, which just doesn't make sense with the present constellation of capitalism, which is just, that's not how factories, it's not like you bring all the workers to LA, the hundreds of thousands of workers to work in the Douglas aircraft plants. So I think there's just on both sides of the political spectrum, it's the very atavistic thinking, 20th century, early 21st century military thinking that I'm not sure the left presently has an answer to, because we don't have the billionaires funding the institutes to do this. But I think this is going to become more interesting as 2028 approaches and the Democratic presidential primary candidates try to put together foreign policy teams. It'll be very interesting to see who they draw from. Like, obviously, Grissom Newsom is going to draw from the Sullivan, but who's AOC going to draw from? Who's even Buttigieg? Buttigieg is not an idiot. Who's he going to draw from? I doubt it's just going to be.
Buttigieg is interesting. I mean, AOC, I think, will have Matt Duss on handling that stuff for her. But
right.
I don't know about Buttigieg, because he's got a finger in, he doesn't have a finger. I was going to say he has a finger in both pies. He's really got his finger up in the air to see which way the wind blows.
Correct.
His MO. Who knows what direction he's going to take.
Yeah, so this will be increasingly interesting. Maybe we should talk about this on the live stream.
That would be a good
idea. For those of you listening, will have happened yesterday.
Yes.
So everyone, thank you very much for listening. We're going to have a merch drop soon with some new art that I'm really excited about. check out those specials, AmericanPrestigePod.com/specials, I believe, or series. listen to what I said at the beginning of the podcast. Check out those series. They're not specials. Anyone who pays the $5 or annual has access to all of those. Thank you for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.